You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this show comes from Mercury. There's an art to making the complex feel simple. Everything should be in sync so that even the smallest part serves a bigger purpose. Simplicity can transform your business operations. That's why Mercury powers your financial workflows from the bank account, so ambitious companies have the precision, control, and focus they need to perform at their best. Apply in minutes at mercury.com.
Sometimes I have this thought in my head, and I know it's a line from Brokeback Mountain, but I just keep thinking, like, why can't the U.S. quit Saudi Arabia? Right? It's this way of phrasing it that gets stuck in my head over and over again. But it's also a pressing foreign policy problem in that the Saudi government is one of the more vicious regimes on the list of vicious regimes around the world. They're extremely repressive. Their foreign policy involves a series of atrocities in the region, most notably in Yemen, where their war has cost an untold number of lives, especially civilian lives, given the way that they've conducted it. It's a very difficult state for the United States, given its stated values, to be aligned with. And yet somehow, the U.S. doesn't really make any moves to get out of this alliance. So today on Worldly, part of the Vox Media podcast network, we're going to talk about the interconnections between the United States and Saudi Arabia and why, despite everything, the U.S. can't seem to quit its very distasteful ally. I'm Zach Beauchamp, here, as always, with Jen Williams and Alex Ward.
Hey.
So which one is Saudi Arabia, Heath Ledger or Jake Gyllenhaal?
God, I don't remember well enough to be able to say which is which. Like, it's been a long time since that movie came out.
Worldly listeners, just so you know, none of us were prepared for Zach to go that route in the intro. And we're all very excited and surprised to hear that he went the Brokeback Mountain route for U.S. Saudi policy, but we support it. Let's go.
It's true. They both started laughing at me partway through. I couldn't tell if it was laughing with or laughing at, so I had to like stop talking for a little. Oh, yes. Okay, good. All right. Also, worldly listeners, for those of you who might have been too young to remember or are not American and don't follow American pop culture, Brokeback Mountain was a famous love story about two cowboys played by Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal. So movie was a real cultural touchstone quite a few years ago, and apparently I can't seem to quit Brokeback Mountain references either. But look, this is a really exciting episode because in the second half, Jen has an interview with Senator Chris Murphy, who's one of the leading thinkers on foreign policy in Congress. That may sound like damning with faint praise, but Senator Murphy has really been out front on a lot of this stuff, and in particular has been a vocal critic of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And in that second half, Senator Murphy talks about his plan for reorienting and revising the U.S.-Saudi relationship. So stick around for that. But first, we're going to give you a little bit of grounding. I mean, Alex, maybe why don't you start talking a little bit about why it is that the United States got tangled up with Saudi Arabia in the first place?
Sure. I mean, really since 1945, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have had a kind of bargain, which was Saudi Arabia would provide the U.S. with pretty cheap oil to run its economy, and the U.S. would provide weapons and protection and economic stimulus. And over time, this grew into sort of a oil for security partnership. Again, we would provide weapons and they would help us, you know, fight against terrorists and counter Iran and all that, and we would take the oil. However, that has changed a bit in recent years because now, as we've talked about on previous episodes, the U.S. is now a major energy producer. And so that has lessened in terms of the oil for security trade, let's say. That is no longer as big an issue now. However, when you talk to people in any administration, Republican or Democrat, they'll say, look, the Saudis, despite being, you know, unsavory characters on many issues, they are still very helpful in many areas, including, again, buying our weapons. That gives a lot of money, countering Iran, trying to stabilize certain parts of the Middle East, whether that be sending money to make northeastern Syria a bit better in Lebanon and elsewhere. And then, of course, they just give money to the American economy in general. And so, again, despite, you know, the Washington and Riyadh having tons of problems over the years, lest we forget that a lot of the 9/11 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, causing strife in the relationship, at the end of the day, the U.S. has found that Saudi, on the whole, has been better than not as a partner because of all these other interests that the U.S. is pursuing, economic and security-wise.
I don't know. Maybe I am the resident Saudi hawk. Maybe the only thing I'll be the resident hawk on this show. But it really strikes me, and I guess I tipped my hand earlier in the intro, right, that a lot of the U.S.-Saudi relationship has outlived its original rationales, right? Like, part of the early argument was that you need oil supplies from Saudi Arabia. Well, that's not really nearly as important given the way that the energy economy works and the fact that the U.S. now is such a big oil producer domestically and given the shift to renewable energies, right? So that's not as important, right? Obviously, the Cold War origins of needing, you know, somebody to counter Soviet influence no longer apply. And so the argument is basically the U.S., without its close ties to Saudi Arabia, it leaves a regional vacuum that allows for Iran and other foreign powers to have more influence in the region, except does that justify the level of closeness we have with Saudi Arabia given the costs of the alliance? And I mean just both reputationally and human, right? A lot of people have died in the Yemen war. Saudi Arabia assassinated a U.S. resident, Jamal Khashoggi, who is a columnist for the Washington Post. The Biden administration announced, even after declassifying intelligence that was unequivocal, that Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, was responsible for this, didn't do anything directly, right? It said they were not going to impose punishments on MBS, specifically in retaliation for this. It just seems like we are letting the Saudis get away with truly atrocious behavior on the basis of, I think, somewhat questionable assumptions about why we need Saudi Arabia today.
Yeah, I want to push back a little bit on the argument that it's about, you know, U.S. maintaining U.S. access to Saudi oil and to Gulf oil more broadly. I would actually argue it's a little bit more nuanced than that. It's not as much just making sure that the U.S. in particular has access to this oil. It's also very much historically been about denying access to others, in particular the Soviet Union for a long time. And now, you know, very much Iran, and making sure that Iran isn't able to kind of dominate the oil kind of market in the region. In particular, you know, the sanctions on Iran that are related both to human rights and to the nuclear program very much have, you know, hampered Iran's ability to be a significant player in the oil industry in the way that it could, given its reserves. And so I think, you know, it's a little bit facile, I think, to just say that it's about U.S. oil, and that the other side of that, which is that, well, now that we are a huge shale oil producer, et cetera, that we don't need that. I think that calculation hasn't actually changed in the sense that, you know, the kind of calculation of denying kind of influence, denying, you know, other kind of adversarial countries access there, I think that's very much still in play. The terrorism argument, I think, is a little bit complicated too. Alex, you know, you rightly said that today the U.S.-Saudi relationship is about countering terrorism, but it very much is because of 9/11 that is the case, that we see Saudi in any way, shape, or form as a partner in terrorism when they were, you know, one of the largest, you know, exporters of the extremist kind of Wahhabist ideology that motivated, you know, the 9/11 hijackers and Al-Qaeda and to some degree ISIS. And so, you know, I think that relationship has certainly changed. But it's also just, you know, logistics, right? We needed to be friends with Saudi to be able to operate in the region for things like the Iraq War, for things like the Gulf War. So I think it's a lot more complicated than that. I think, you know, Saudi is very strategically located in the region. So I don't think it's just U.S. oil. I think that's a bit too simplistic.
So I just want to make sure our listeners understand what is at stake here or what was done. So after the Biden administration released the Khashoggi intelligence report, they announced a couple of things. One, which was sanctions on 70 plus members of a, you know, kill team, effectively, who are a part of the plot against Khashoggi. You had the creation of the Khashoggi ban, which is now a U.S. effort to impose visa restrictions on officials who go after dissidents abroad, et cetera, et cetera. And no sanctions whatsoever on MBS, no punishment directly. And that's what people are focusing on, really, is because Biden, during the campaign, basically said, like, you know, Saudi Arabia is a pariah state and there's no redeeming value in this government. And I'm going to go after the senior leadership. Well, that would mean Mohammed bin Salman as the crown prince, the king's son, and the de facto leader of the country. So this is what people are angry about, is that MBS himself seemed to have skirted, any repercussion. That said, what the Biden team would tell you is that this is a recalibration, not a rupture, of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And the reason they say that is because that they'll go, look, MBS used to have direct access, basically, to the Oval Office, calling the president, WhatsApping with Jared Kushner all the time. That is no longer the case. Right now, MBS's direct American counterpart is Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, because MBS is a defense minister. They have said that, you know, basically there's no special relationship now between the U.S. and Saudi. It's just sort of like another country that's out there. We have frozen weapons, right? Weapon sales, a decent amount of weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. And so if you think about it, what this team is basically saying is that, like, look, you know, Saudi is no longer a very important country to us. It is a partner, and we need it to be a partner. We will still defend it, against Houthi attacks. We won't help them offensively. It's just there's been a downgrading of the relationship. And that, for them, counts as a larger punishment because, and I'll end this in a moment, is because, you know, of all the interests that we've talked about, the security interests, the economic interests, you know, MBS is already the de facto ruler, will inevitably be king unless something massive changes. So why end that relationship over the Khashoggi murder? There are larger interests at stake. That's how the Biden team sees it, which, somewhat in an unsavory way, puts them in line with how Trump saw the whole relationship. Trump was basically like, I don't want to rupture this relationship because they pour a bunch of money into the American economy. Now, Biden has and his team have said this in a much nicer way, and they've done more. But anyway, that's really what's going on here. Is the concern, I think, a bit oddly, is stuck on, we didn't do too much on MBS without really looking at all the other things we've done. Because if you think about it as well, like, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin have done really bad things. We haven't sanctioned them either, but we have downgraded those relationships. And people don't really seem, like, all worked up about, well, why haven't we attacked them personally?
So I will say, you know, in the defense, and in no way do I mean to defend MBS or the Saudi regime, which are—
You do not, under any circumstances, got to hand it to them.
Exactly. Just atrocious when it comes to human rights and all sorts of things. But sanctioning MBS, the fact that he literally is the defense minister and that we have U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia would just logistically cause major headaches. But I think that gets back to the core question that Zach opened us with, which is, so why can't we quit Saudi Arabia, right? So, okay, yes, that would cause logistical problems, but what if we just didn't have troops in Saudi Arabia, right? And so I think the question there, you know, I don't think you can look at this also without talking about Iran and, you know, in some, you know, to some degree, Israel as well and U.S. support for Israel, right? I think, you know, the Saudi-U.S. relationship and the Saudi-Israel relationship has really developed, you know, into an even stronger kind of partnership because, and, you know, in order to counter the threat from Iran, both regionally and to Israel, you know, in the region and to the United States more broadly. And I think taking that out and not looking at the Iran kind of piece of this really misses a huge dynamic.
Yeah, I what I like about that point, Jen, and this whole broader conversation about Saudi Arabia is it forces a more fundamental conversation, right? About, like, what is the United States doing in the Middle East? What is the point of this large U.S. deployment there? And, like, you know, one way to answer that question the way that Jen was just doing is to say, well, countering Iran. But then the question becomes, why do we want to do that? Right? Like, why do we care about that? Why can't we let the Saudis and the Israelis handle that without as significant a U.S. deployment and, by necessity, as significant an amount of U.S. support for human rights abuses conducted by the Saudi regime, particularly, but also Israel, in pursuit of these goals and other relevant domestic or regional goals? I think that's a really hard question. It's also one that is only increasingly being talked about in the U.S., I think, since the first Gulf War. There's been a largely unexamined assumption in the D.C. foreign policy conversation, which I want to bracket from the like academic foreign policy conversation, which has been very, very, very different in terms of its area of focus. But I think a largely unexamined assumption that it is good for the United States to play a kind of more assertive, forward deployed role in the Middle East, that we are good at guaranteeing regional stability and ensuring that global oil markets are safe, ensuring that no one power gets a hand up or a leg up in the region, right? These are generally areas of competence for the United States. But since the Iraq War, there's been a lot of evidence that the United States, at least through active involvement and management to the degree that it's done in the Middle East, has made things worse rather than better. And so you get an argument that maybe, you know, regional balancing could happen on its own without such a close U.S. relationship with an unsavory government like the Saudis. I'm not saying I agree with this fully. I agree with it in part, I guess. I think people who advocate this view, restrainers, often is like sort of the term in Washington right now, often go way too far in terms of like what, like sort of rosy assumptions about what would happen in the absence of U.S. involvement. But the fundamental criticism, I think, is worth making. Like, why are we taking sides in the Saudi-Iranian dispute? What is the purpose of doing that?
Well, to some degree, I would say part of that is Iran's fault in the sense that death to America is literally one of the raison d'etres of the Iranian regime. That tends to bring you into the conflict when they are literally saying death to America. At the same time, you know, the U.S.-Israel relationship, again, Iran is very much interested in undoing the state of Israel and has very actively created militia groups in the region, specifically Hezbollah, that has fought literal wars with Israel. So I think it's not exactly just theoretical. Like, why do we not like Iran? Like, well, Iran super doesn't like us, first of all. And, you know, has done some pretty provocative things towards the United States. To be fair, we have done some pretty provocative things to them as well, such as overthrowing a democratically elected leader at one point. But, you know, I think more generally, you know, again, you can't look at Saudi without looking at Iran, and you can't look at Iran without looking at Israel. And so I think, you know, trying to take the Saudi relationship qua the United States as a kind of unitary entity here is problematic because, you know, it overlooks a lot of the history, right, of going back, like you said, to the Gulf War, going back to the Iraq War, right? There's a lot of, you know, important kind of interest there. And specifically, you know, with Iran, the U.S. also has a vested interest in non-proliferation and trying to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And the reason, the main, if not the only reason that the U.S. ended up supporting Saudi's war in Yemen was to get them on side and stop vocally complaining about the Iran deal. So again, I think there are vested U.S. interests in the region, and having Saudi Arabia, you know, on our side, if you want to put it that way, for some of these things has proven to be strategically useful. Now, morally, you know, yes, reprehensible, absolutely. But I think the strategic calculation has been pretty clear.
Yeah, I mean, I will dedicate this next section using another Brokeback Mountain line, which is, if you can't fix it, Jack, you got to stand it. I find the restraining argument fascinating in the sense that, like, they want out of the Middle East, they don't want American engagement. But if you want to pursue any U.S. interest in the Middle East, you kind of need Saudi Arabia. And, like, right, as we've been describing, if you want to counter Iran, if you want to keep Israel safe, if you know, want to have some troops in the region, not many, but like if you're looking for American interests to be advanced, take Saudi Arabia out of the equation. What do you have left? You have some other countries, of course, but like Saudi Arabia is a major player in that region. And so you're effectively, like, if you rupture the Saudi Arabia relationship, then you're either scrambling to find something else or you're just fine letting that region go the way it goes without your input. That I find not a great thing to do. And like it sucks to say that because let's be clear. I mean, what's different about this issue and why we're talking about it so passionately and a bunch of people are is that, you know, the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia did order the killing of a U.S. resident. That is different. That is new. And that is why it feels almost like a personal attack on the United States, that as much as we care about the Saudi relationship in general, they don't seem to care about or respect it as much as we do. But again, you have to make that calculation in your head. These are the tough, horrible choices in foreign policy. You know, do you forego or weaken your ability to obtain interests, many of which are economic and security in the Middle East, over Khashoggi's murder? And it's unsavory and it sucks to say, but you're probably not. And I would imagine most administrations, Republican or Democrat, feel that same way. And clearly the Biden team made that assessment after reviewing what the Trump team had thought.
Yeah, I mean, that is true if you assume that like active U.S. deployment in the region and like close involvement with Saudi Arabia is the best way to safeguard American interests in the way that you're describing them. But what if it's not, right? Like, Saudi Arabia is an extremely wealthy oil state. Israel is by far the most powerful military force in the region, and it doesn't really need American military aid at this point to maintain its military edge. At least the degree of military aid that the U.S. provides right now is probably not necessary for Israel, given its domestic economy and the real proven strength of the IDF as a fighting force, to protect itself. Plus, it has a nuclear deterrent, which no other state in the Middle East currently has, though they don't say they have it. So if our views, right, our concerns about U.S. interests are making sure the oil is flowing, well, that's in Saudi's interest, making sure that Israel is safe, well, Israel is doing a pretty good job of maintaining that on its own, and in limiting Iranian influence, well, the Saudis and the Israelis have their own interests in doing so, and they have the financial and military capabilities to do that on their own without active U.S. involvement. What does the United States gain by virtue of maintaining such a close relationship with these countries, right? You can make the argument that some elements of this alliance, for instance, not being willing to go after the Saudis more aggressively, not only hurts U.S. reputational credibility in terms of our ability to condemn human rights in other places, but also actively makes us involved in doing horrific things to people in the Middle East, which in turn makes us much less credible and popular among different states in the Middle East, which is really important if we're concerned about the promotion of democracy in the region. We're concerned about not providing credibility to the Iranian narrative that the United States is some kind of neo-crusader power bent on destroying Islam and killing Muslims, which is also the Al-Qaeda-ISIS narrative, right? So if we're concerned about terrorism, especially given that Saudi Arabia has promoted extremist ideologies for quite some time, maybe it would be better if we limited and distanced ourselves from Gulf monarchies and other authoritarian states like Egypt. Maybe if we're more hands-off, the region can come to a balance on its own that secures the basic goods that you two have outlined in this conversation without such direct and counterproductive U.S. involvement.
Sorry, let me provide a very concrete example of why I think people are siding with the, like, keep the relationship going argument. Nuclear weapons, right? Because Saudi Arabia has shown an interest in nuclear development, and many people are worried that it's going to get a nuclear weapon if the U.S. doesn't protect it writ large. And so if you don't like the U.S.-Saudi relationship now, you're definitely not going to like it when Saudi Arabia has a nuclear weapon, and what that could lead to an arms race in the Middle East, especially if, you know, we're not countering Saudi, if we're not working with Saudi to counter Iran as much. Obviously Israel will be like, what the heck, guys? So this is part of the problem. And I think part of the calculus is, like, you know, one of the trades that we do here is Saudi, right, gives us money for stuff. And we're like, we'll basically protect you. Hence the Yemen thing. We're not going to do offensive operations, but we will protect you against Houthi attacks. That's smaller, but that's basically like, they are sort of under our security umbrella. If they don't feel that umbrella and it starts raining, they're going to perhaps pursue that nuclear weapon. And that's sort of one of the big fears here. Now, some people would say that Saudi holding American policy hostage. Yeah, probably. But would you rather be held hostage? Would you rather Saudi Arabia have a nuclear weapon? These are the choices that are part of this whole discussion.
Zach, your point, I think, it is fair to some degree in terms of Israel and Saudi Arabia being able to counter Iran on their own. In some ways, I could see that maybe being a fair argument, except very big hole in that, which is naval power. The Israelis and the Saudis, neither of them have a very strong navy. And sure, you know, by pulling out U.S. naval assets, you could theoretically force the Saudis to become a stronger naval power, but that's not something you can really do overnight. And very much the fact that the U.S. is involved specifically in the Strait of Hormuz goes back especially to the tanker wars during the Iran-Iraq War. And the need for U.S. naval ships to literally escort tankers going through the region because the Iranians kept bombing the tankers. So, you know, I think just saying that the U.S. should remove troops kind of generally sounds good in theory from the region. But when you actually look at what those troops are doing, where they are, right, are, you know, do you want to get rid of U.S. naval assets in the region? What are you going to do? Are you going to get rid of those bases? Are you going to try to have sea basing capabilities, which we currently do not have to the degree that would allow us to continue to do the full range of functions that we have? I think there are real questions about the ability of those countries to do the broader range of activities. Now, you can argue that the U.S. shouldn't be doing those activities, fine, but somebody's got to protect those tankers because Iran's not going to stop doing that. I mean, they literally keep doing this all the time, interdicting tankers going through the region. And one of the concerns is that if they were to, you know, continue to do that and escalate it, it would cause a major rupture in global oil prices and stability. And so somebody needs to be the guarantor there. Saudi's naval capabilities are not going to do it. The Chinese are developing naval bases, you know, a naval base in Djibouti nearby, but they're not in any way, shape, or form currently capable of playing that role to the degree the U.S. is. So I think there, you're not going to see the Israelis and the Saudis really stepping up their game.
So, Jen, I think that's a really good point. And I think it's one of the weaknesses in the restrainer case that I've been pressing so far is that there's not a good transition proposal, right? It's just generally taken as, in the argument that I've been adopting, not quite for the sake of argument, because it's kind of closer to my views, but not fully, right, what I think. One of the weaknesses is that it's, they don't have a good account of how to get from point A to point B, right? From a world in which the U.S. is playing this really active role to one in which it's basically not involved in the Middle East at all, without in the interim there being significant amounts of chaos. What I like about the arguments is they force us to think more seriously about what can and can't be provided by specific U.S. deployments as they currently exist. So, like, the point about keeping the sea lanes open is, like, a really just generally strong argument for U.S. forward military deployment and military hegemony throughout the world. If you hear some screaming, that's because my baby just showed up. I apologize. She has woken up. But right now, she's not screaming. She's very happy. Anyway, I think that's right. There's a question of recalibrating, right, of whether the degree to which we have aligned ourselves with the Saudi quest to deal with Iranian forward deployments throughout the region is beneficial. Yemen is, to me, the sort of paradigmatic case, right? Like, we maybe could have just dealt with the Saudis whining about the Iranian nuclear deal without having to help them murder thousands of people, which is essentially what the United States has done there. I think it's probably the case that the U.S. turned a blind eye to some of their activities in Syria that ended up aiding extremist groups in that region, partially because of the tightness of the U.S. alliance. And more broadly, I mean, Iran isn't just saying death to America in a vacuum, right? They're not just like, we hate the United States because we hate the United States, right? It's that the more aggressively the U.S. acts and treats Iran as its enemy, going back to the toppling of Mossadegh, right, which you can debate the extent to which the U.S. was involved in this coup in the 50s in Iran and the extent to which U.S. action was responsible for Mossadegh's toppling. But there's a long history there that leads to this being popular. And if the U.S. soft pedals or backpedals from its hostility towards Iran and its tightness with Iran's regional enemies, it's possible the Iranians might be less angry at the United States. It is a difficult question, and I'm not convinced that the Biden administration's rebalancing approach goes nearly far enough from where we've been in the past.
It might not go far enough, but it's gone further than most administrations have. I mean, again, let's be clear. The end of support for Yemen operations, the freezing of weapons, you know, the downgrading of a crown prince's general standing, or at least standing over the last 4 years in the U.S., the sanctioning of some pretty high-level folks in the country, not the most high-level folks, but some, that's pretty harsh for U.S.-Saudi relations in history. And I think perhaps one more thing, I think there's going to be a norm change. It used to be that the U.S. really only criticized Saudi's internal politics on sort of two issues. One was Wahhabism bad, stop teaching that and exporting that, and like let women drive. And that was kind of the extent of our human rights discussions. And now you're seeing, at least this administration, and allowing a bunch of other Democrats and some Republicans being like, you guys are bad on a lot of stuff. And it used to be that that was sort of taboo to say because we were worried about, you know, would Saudi Arabia not want to be our friends anymore? And if that norm has gone away, if it is becoming at least more acceptable to criticize internal Saudi society and politicking, then it becomes a more normal relationship. Then it's like, okay, well, on the stuff where our interests align, you know, we will work together. And there's a lot of areas where interests align. But on the human rights stuff, you know, we're going to call you out. And again, we've done that in general, but it's more forceful now. And that, I think, is a decent change and one that I hope continues. But I still think that I think it's completely fair to say the recalibration of the Biden administration hasn't gone far enough. That is totally fair. But there has been a recalibration. And I defy anyone to find me another administration since 1945, especially, who has downgraded the relationship as much.
So we're going to take a quick break here. And with all that in mind, I really hope you stick around for Jen's conversation with Senator Murphy, because what he does is he takes some of the themes that we've been discussing in sort of broad strokes here and tries to turn them into a very specific policy proposal for how to reorient the U.S. relationship with the Saudis and Gulf monarchs in general. It shows how tricky and difficult managing a transition away from Saudi Arabia might be in practice, but also makes a forceful case for why it's worthwhile. Take a listen after the break.
Support for this show comes from Mercury. Financial operations are needlessly complex. Startups have to cobble together a patchwork of tools to reconcile transactions from different sources and struggle to glean answers from platforms that speak different languages. Simplicity can transform your business operations. That's why Mercury powers your financial workflows from the bank account, so you can pay bills faster, stay in control of company spending, and speed up reconciliation. Apply in minutes at mercury.com and join over 100,000 ambitious startups that trust Mercury, not just for banking and credit cards, but for the precision, control, and focus they need to transform their financial workflows and perform at their best. Mercury, the art of simplified finances. Apply in minutes at mercury.com. Mercury is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services provided by Choice Financial Group and Evolve Bank and Trust. Members FDIC.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries, not including...
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
So, Senator Chris Murphy, welcome to Worldly, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sure. So, in a recent article in Foreign Affairs, you laid out a fairly comprehensive new U.S. strategy toward the Gulf, and that's really what I want to chat with you about today. It's a very, you know, ambitious kind of new way of looking at U.S. foreign policy goals and approach to the Gulf in particular. And you say it's to create a more substantive and stable link between the U.S. and the GCC countries. So for our listeners, a reminder, that's the Gulf Cooperation Council countries. So Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, or UAE. So we're going to link to your piece in Foreign Affairs in the show notes so our listeners can actually read the full thing, so they don't have to just rely on my quick summary here. And I'll summarize some of the key points in the questions as we go along. So I'm just going to jump right into it. So you argue that the first step in this new strategy should be for the U.S. to disengage from what you say the GCC proxy wars with Iran. And you say specifically in Yemen, in Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria. So I kind of wanted to dig into that a little bit, because when we look at it a little closer, you know, Yemen in particular is really kind of one of the places where the U.S. was actually involved in supporting specifically a GCC proxy war with Iran. But, you know, there's no proxy war in Lebanon that U.S. forces are engaged in. You know, the U.S. troop presence in Iraq is mostly meant to, you know, counter ISIS. That's the counter ISIS mission. Same thing with Syria. And, you know, the Biden administration has just now ended offensive support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. So I wanted to get your thoughts kind of on where you actually see the problematic U.S. involvement in proxy wars today, right now, and kind of going forward.
Sure. Well, listen, I make the argument in this piece that we've got to right-size the relationship for today. Back in the 1970s and 1980s, the United States was essentially running on oil that came from the Gulf. That is simply not the case today. We import less oil today than we create domestically. And of the oil that we import, a really small share of that comes from the Gulf. And so we created the security guarantee for Gulf countries 40 years ago, when if the Gulf was under attack, then the U.S. economy would go into lockdown. That just isn't the case today. We import more oil from Mexico than we import from Saudi Arabia. And so I think it's important to understand that context when I make the argument that we don't need to be as engaged in these proxy wars. The reason that we are engaged in proxy wars very often is to support GCC countries. That's why we were involved in the Saudi side of the Yemen war. And so the proxy wars I'm talking about are both hot wars and cold wars. The hot wars are Yemen and Syria, and to an extent, Libya, which is not sort of the same proxy war, Iran against the Sunni nations. In Libya, it's much more confusing. And, you know, an example of a cold war would be either Lebanon or Iraq, which is both hot and cold at times. And to me, it just doesn't matter as much as people would think to the United States whether one side or the other ultimately wins the contest for regional hegemony in the Middle East, the Turks or the Saudis or the Iranians. I'm not saying it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter as much as it did 40 years ago. But second, you know, we have all sorts of experience since the Iraq war about the efficacy of U.S. military involvement in the region. And what we have found is that our presence there often draws extremists into the region, often becomes recruiting material for groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And so the deeper we're involved in these proxy wars, I think the longer they sometimes last, because U.S. presence is escalatory, not de-escalatory. And again, I'm just not sure that we have the interests we used to have when it comes to, you know, whether the Saudis or the Iranians win.
Sure. So, and in particular, you know, when it comes to Syria and Iraq, you know, as I said, a lot of that is mostly just focused on the counter-ISIS mission. Is that something that you still think the U.S. should be actively engaged in? Or do you think that the Biden administration or, you know, future administrations, do you think we should pull back on that in particular or reduce troop levels? How do you see that kind of conflict?
Well, listen, I think we still have to be involved in the fight against ISIS. And part of my argument is that we should get out of Yemen because ISIS has been getting stronger over the years as the Yemen civil war has persisted. And so I think there are actions we're taking in the region that is frankly expanding the efforts of ISIS or aiding their recruitment efforts. I think inside Syria, our actions by and large extended that civil war, which again gave operating space to ISIS. So I think if we are taking the fight directly to ISIS, I think that's a worthy endeavor. I don't think it's actually presently authorized by Congress. So I don't think the administration can pursue those efforts without coming to Congress and getting an updated war authorization. it's all the other fights that we've been involved in against Bashar al-Assad, against the Houthis, that I don't believe are in U.S. national security interests. I don't believe are authorized by Congress. And I would argue that the Biden administration should look to end.
Got it. So another one of the planks of your strategy, you say that U.S. should basically stop selling offensive weapons and military equipment to the GCC countries. Though you do say for sure that we should continue and perhaps, you know, increase selling defensive capabilities, defensive weapons to those countries. And I know you've addressed this in the piece briefly. And in, I saw you speak recently on this argument at one of the think tank events. I'm not sure which one. I don't remember, unfortunately. But you know, the main argument against that, as you acknowledge, you know, would be that those countries would simply turn to Russia and China for those offensive weapons if the U.S. were to cut it off. So what is your response to that argument, kind of more broadly?
Well, first of all, I mean, I am comfortable selling defensive weapons to our allies, but only under certain circumstances. I mean, I just don't think we should be in the business of selling major offensive systems to countries like Saudi Arabia and UAE that are actively using them in theaters that where hostilities don't accrue to the benefit of the United States, or transferring those weapons to really bad actors. The UAE, for instance, has a history of sending, you know, both offensive and defensive weapons into Libya and to very dangerous extremist militias inside Yemen. But to the extent that I am comfortable down the road sending defensive systems, I do think that we, you know, have to understand that this is a bit of a red herring, that if we're not in the business of selling offensive weapons, the Chinese or the Russians will fill the void. First of all, there's no substitute for the capability of U.S. systems, and it would be a massive project for any of our Gulf partners to essentially reorient their defensive posture or their offensive posture so as to integrate Russian systems. Russian systems aren't as good, and it would be wildly expensive to bring them in. Second, Russia's going to be a tooth and nail competitor to the Gulf as oil revenues continue to decline. And all of a sudden, the Russians and the Gulf nations are scrambling to try to gather up as big a share of the declining world oil market as they can. I don't know that you want to be in business with your primary economic competitor when it comes to your own nation's security. And the Chinese, they are just not interested in getting involved in security guarantees in the Middle East. Maybe they will be 30 or 40 years from now, but right now they want to be economic partners. The Chinese Navy is not coming to the defense of Saudi Arabia anytime soon. So I just don't think any of those countries are going to get the kind of security partnership offers from the Chinese that, you know, some of the sky will fall folks suggest if the United States pulls back. So my case here is that we can afford to drive a harder bargain, even when it comes to defensive weapons, because I just don't believe these countries are going to say, hey, we're not going to make civil domestic political reforms because we're very comfortable with weaning ourselves off of U.S. security assistance and turning to Russia. I just don't think that's going to happen.
Sure. So I want to push back a little bit on the Russia part in particular, but a bit on China too. You know, so first of all, you know, to be fair, Russia's defense industry is, you know, one tech-intensive sector where the country actually holds an international leadership position. You know, Russian weaponry is actually relatively inexpensive, especially compared to U.S. weapon systems. It's often actually more robust than a lot of its U.S. counterparts in specific sectors. In some cases, technologically, they can't compete, but I think in a lot of ways, in particular in terms of firepower, they do actually pretty well. I'm sure you know Russia has already sold missile systems to the UAE. They sold military rifles to the kingdom, to Saudi Arabia. So, you know, and on the kind of issue of the falling oil prices, I think that's a really good point. But if you look at Moscow's kind of approach toward the Middle East, you know, one of the ways it's looking to actually shore up its kind of revenue streams from the declining oil prices is by actually expanding arms sales big time into the Middle East, looking at, to that as a kind of supplement. So I guess I kind of wonder there, you know, there's the kind of concern that, you know, on top of the fact that the systems are actually relatively inexpensive, that they're robust. They also come with fewer strings attached, right? So, you know, the U.S., to our credit, I would very much say, has, you know, limits on what you can do with U.S. weapons. You know, no secondary sales, ostensibly. Those kind of limits don't come with Russian weapons. You know, they also are delivered a lot faster because they don't have to go through our bureaucracy. So I kind of, you know, I feel like maybe dismissing Russia is a little unfair, given that they are very much, you know, actively trying to expand in that market. And also, you know, if you look at it, our influence, you know, U.S. influence and pressure is one of the few reasons that the Saudis and the Emiratis in particular haven't actually gone further with purchasing Russian weapon systems.
So, I mean, two responses. One, I don't doubt that the Russians have an interest in selling more weapons into the region. My point is, I think the Saudis and the Emiratis, who do understand the future trajectory of their oil sales, who do understand that they need a much more diversified economy, are going to be reluctant to pin themselves to Russia as a security partner rather than the United States. Because let's just be honest, if they turn their back on the United States when it comes to the security partnership, we're not going to be interested in being the kind of potential economic partners that they would like over the next 20 to 30 years. And there is no way to diversify Saudi Arabia or UAE's economy without an economic partnership with the United States. So I think that is just a chilling factor on the Gulf's interest in essentially forsaking the United States as a security partner and turning to the Russians. And second, you are right that we put these conditions on our weapons sales, conditions that have been regularly violated by the Saudis and the Emiratis.
Fair enough.
The question is, you know, do you want to be in business with a partner who uses your weapons to bomb school buses inside Yemen, or in the case of the Emiratis, openly transfers the weapons and the vehicles you give them to Salafist aligned militias inside Yemen? So conditions are great when your partners, you know, abide by them. But when they don't, I think there's a question as to whether you are just better off letting them go and buying their weapons from somebody else.
Sure. And, you know, I wanted to just on the China question quickly, you know, again, China has sold military drones to Saudi and UAE. And I absolutely take your point. I think that there's a very, you know, big difference between selling military hardware, especially something like drones, compared to having your Navy, you know, defend Bahrain, for instance, if it were attacked. At the same time, you know, China did build its first ever permanent overseas military base, a big naval base in Djibouti, right across Bab el-Mandeb, you know, from Yemen. And they have actually participated very much in, if not security guarantees, but in definitely in, you know, security support systems for tankers and those kinds of missions, in particular in the Strait. And so, you know, I guess I kind of wonder, is there a concern there in terms of strategic competition with China? The fact that, you know, that base can potentially house up to 10,000 Chinese troops. It can ostensibly hold their new aircraft carriers, assault carriers, could probably accommodate up to 4 of their nuclear-powered submarines. Is that a concern at all when it comes to the broader U.S. competition with China in the region? The fact that they are rapidly expanding, including during the COVID pandemic, they haven't stopped work on the base. Is that a concern at all for you?
Well, it's a concern. I just, and again, I'm admitting that it is not implausible that at some point down the line, the Chinese are interested in getting involved with the Gulf at the level we are today. I just don't think in the foreseeable future, they're going to be able to offer any of the kinds of security guarantees, implicit or explicit, that that we do. Listen, there's a broader question to ask here as the United States becomes less and less reliant on oil from the Gulf, and the Gulf becomes more and more of a supplier of energy to China. You know, I mean, that's the reality right now, right? Is that right now China is the primary customer of the Gulf, not the United States. We were involved in a security guarantee in the Gulf for decades because of our oil partnership. So, you know, query whether or not the Chinese should be more responsible for maintaining security in the Gulf rather than the United States if the product there matters more to them than to us. I don't know that I have the answer to that. But again, I just think it's really important for us to remember why we were involved in that region to begin with. It's not just oil, right? We have had and still have a longstanding commitment to the security of Israel. But the Chinese are going to be the primary customers of the Gulf. They are going to be more involved in the region because the oil there matters more to them. I don't know that that's in their long-term interest to have oil from a fairly unstable place, be so important to them. We're just smart as a nation if we are pursuing a policy to make ourselves more reliant on domestic sources of renewable energy.
Sure. So I want to get to one of the other parts of this kind of related. You argue that the U.S. should reduce military basing in the Gulf. And I think specifically you suggested reconsidering the costs and benefits of basing the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain would be a good place to start. I believe you also mentioned Al Udeid Air Base in your talk recently. But focusing on the Fifth Fleet basing, this is not a new kind of suggestion, right? This is something that has been actually reconsidered over and over again. These considerations have been kind of looked at. Every time the U.S. has come to the conclusion, and analysts independently as well, that the benefits actually vastly outweigh the cost, that relocating the Fifth Fleet would be a massive logistical nightmare, first of all, and would actually end up costing tens of billions of dollars and would essentially just leave the U.S. stuck trying to replicate that base somewhere else in the region and starting to kind of rebuild it all over again, from scratch. Of course, it would also, I'm sure you know, make Iran incredibly happy to have the U.S. evacuating or leaving from Bahrain. Iran, for listeners, Iran has had territorial claims to Bahrain since the British occupied it in the early 1800s. And going back to the kind of security issue of our allies, moving the Fifth Fleet, moving our naval CENTCOM base from Bahrain would also potentially undermine the actual commitment that you're saying to our GCC allies, in the sense that we would literally have to, remove the Patriot missile batteries that actually protect Bahrain and to some degree Saudi Arabia. So I guess my question here, given all of those very real costs, what are the benefits that you actually see from reconsidering and relocating the U.S. Fifth Fleet?
Well, in the piece, I certainly preview that the first thing you should consider is the Fifth Fleet. But I would likely make the argument that that's the beginning, not the end. I think that we need to just have a tough conversation about our military footprint in the region and whether that footprint is more trouble than it's worth. Yes, it is always expensive in the short run to move troops. But we have been talking in Washington for now a decade about the need to spend more time focusing on Asia or the Africa or the Western Hemisphere and less time focusing on the Middle East. Part of the reason that we focus on the Middle East is because that's where our troops are. And so if you begin a process of demilitarizing the U.S. presence in the Gulf, I would suggest that you are going to actually move assets permanently out of that region to other regions, places that are more important to the United States today. So in the long run, I think it's part of what allows Washington to be able to sort of reorient our priorities towards other places. Second, I think there is tremendous downside to continuing to have this kind of presence there. Our troops throughout the region are sitting ducks. As we speak today, we are talking once again about another rocket attack on U.S. troops in Iraq. We have been talking over the past few years about the Russians targeting U.S. troops in Afghanistan. When we have so many troops deployed to dangerous places without adequate protection, they become targets and they drag, and those attacks on our troops drag us into these retaliatory cycles that are not good for anybody. In addition, our troops end up being, as I mentioned before, recruitment fodder for extremist groups. And they force us often to look the other way when it comes to the brutal treatment of regimes against their own people. Bahrain is a perfect example, right? Bahrain, over the past 5 years, their human rights record has gotten worse, not better, with respect to their treatment of the Shia population. And if we really want to rebrand the United States in the world, if we want to be able to recover from the last 4 years of Donald Trump and be a leader again when it comes to human rights and democracy promotion, then we shouldn't be so wedded, so embedded with these brutal anti-democratic regimes in the region. And I'm telling you, that's what happens when we have troops inside Qatar, inside Bahrain, inside Kuwait. We have troops in Lebanon, we have troops all throughout the region. We often are forced to look the other way when it comes to the bad things that those governments do. So for that reason alone, I think it's important for us to reorient. And as I mentioned in the piece, we just shouldn't buy the foreign policy consensus in Washington that we need all these troops to protect our interests. Almost all of these bases and our troop number and our troop level numbers are post 9/11 creations. We didn't have this footprint in the Middle East in the 1980s or the 1990s, and we pretty adequately protected our interests there without these bases.
Sure. Well, I mean, to be fair, in the 1980s, Iraq in particular helped counter Iran in the region. So to be fair, we kind of, I guess, bear a little bit of responsibility for the fact that we removed that.
But Jennifer, to press back for a second, I mean, I also am making the point in this piece, we should right-size our worry about Iranian influence in the region, right? Iran is our adversary. Right, we should be interested in trying to reduce their influence in the region, but often our troops inside the region and our military activity in the region has done exactly the opposite of our stated policy. Right, it's our troops in Syria and our military involvement in Syria that has lengthened that civil war and has ultimately made Bashar al-Assad more reliant on Iranian support. It was the Iraq war itself that allowed Iran to essentially enter Iraq and grow their influence. So, you know, again, it's our long history of military involvement in the region, I would argue, and others would argue the opposite side, that has actually expanded Iran's influence. I just don't think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that this massive surge of U.S. military presence in the Middle East over the last 20 years has resulted in Iran being weakened. In fact, I would make the argument the opposite.
Sure. Last question. I know you have to go. You're a very busy man. You know, if I'm sitting in Riyadh or Manama or, you know, any of the kind of Arab Gulf capitals, or honestly, if I'm sitting in Tehran, a lot of this, you know, huge kind of rethink of U.S. military presence in the Gulf in particular and some of these strategic bases that have actually done a pretty good job, particularly in Bahrain, of, you know, keeping Iran from trying to, you know, literally attack Bahrain and Saudi directly. You know, all of this kind of pulling back of offensive arms, pushing the Saudis and the other Gulf countries, you know, on human rights issues, all of this, you know, if I'm in these capitals, looks a lot like a big Iranian wish list, right? These are all things that Iran would really very much like for the U.S. to do. They have long wanted the U.S. out of Bahrain. They have long wanted the U.S. to pull back its security guarantees. So I guess my question finally here is, you know, what is your answer for that? If you're addressing these countries, how does giving Iran a whole kind of wish list of all the things that it very much would like to see, and, you know, on top of trying to re-enter the Iran deal, which would end up lifting a lot of U.S. sanctions on the country, how does that help our allies feel more secure? How does that promote stability in the region? I mean, what do you say to the argument that that looks very much like what Iran would very much like the United States to do?
Yeah, you know, my responsibility is U.S. security. My responsibility is not Saudi security. My responsibility is not Emirati security. To the extent that the United States cares about those countries, it's because there are important U.S. equities involved in the protection of those nations. And the argument I've made for the last several years is that we need to dramatically rethink whether it matters to us as much as it used to or as much as it should, as to whether Iran or the Saudis end up winning the war in the Middle East for regional hegemony. You are suggesting it is a just rock solid U.S. interest to always protect the Gulf side of that equation, and that if the Iranians increase their influence and the Saudis' influence is decreased, that is unquestionably bad for the United States. I don't know that that's the right answer. I've made this case before. I didn't necessarily expound on it in my piece, but the primary extremist threat to the United States today is not Shia extremism. It is Sunni extremism, right? And Sunni extremism has grown all over the world because of the export from the Gulf countries, from Saudi Arabia, of a form of Wahhabi Salafist Islam that is deeply intolerant and has been unfortunately used to pervert the religion into things like ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
Sure.
And we have largely been sort of giving the Saudis a pass on that over the years. And so I'm just making the argument that, yes, we would prefer the Saudi side to prevail because of the declining oil revenues, because of the recent tendency of the Gulf countries to use U.S. military support to commit human rights crimes, and because of their, I think, very unfortunate export of a brand of Islam that helps build extremist groups.
Yeah,
they are bad actors as well.
Maybe
not as bad an actor as Iran, but bad actors.
Yeah, I guess, and I very much take your point. I just want to, you know, when we're talking about human rights in particular, I know that's a big concern for yours, you know, to your eternal credit. I don't think we have enough people in Congress or in the U.S. in particular focusing on human rights. So thank you for your advocacy there. But I think, you know, looking at Iranian influence, I mean, Shia extremism may not be a direct threat to the United States, but it's certainly a massive threat to human rights. I mean, if you look at the assassination of Lukman Slim in Lebanon, you know, you talk about the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. That's a very similar situation. You have massive human rights violations, you know, targeted killings, torture by these very Shia extremist groups. Does that concern you that they're potentially getting stronger, would deeply dent the ability to promote human rights?
It does. It does. And the argument that I'm making is that we often make it sort of seem as if it is Iran's support for terrorist groups that presents the direct threat to the United States, when it has been indirect support from the Gulf to terrorist organizations that probably is the more immediate concern for the United States. And again, my argument here is that de-escalation should be our goal. And so an increased military footprint in the United States, increased U.S. involvement in active theaters like Yemen and Syria is escalatory in my mind. And that escalation over the past 20 years has emboldened Iran, has increased their influence. And so I posit that if the United States withdraws from Yemen, withdraws from Syria, reduces its military footprint in the region, yes, you can make an argument that that is on Iran's wish list. I can also make an argument to you that that can help begin a de-escalatory cycle in the region where there are less active conflicts between Iran and Saudi Arabia. I can argue that that then positions the United States as a more honest broker to try to achieve some kind of regional settlement between Iran and Saudi Arabia that would be good for both parties in the long run. So I just don't have a lot of evidence in front of me that U.S. military presence in the region has accrued to the benefit of U.S. security or has led to the decreased influence of Iran in the region. I argue that it's time to try something new.
Senator Murphy, thank you so much. I know you have to go.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Senator.
I hope, listeners, that you enjoyed Jen's interview with Senator Murphy as much as she clearly did, and we all did listening to it. I want to thank our producer, Sophie Lalonde, for always stitching together these episodes in such a nice way. And I want to encourage all of you to rate and subscribe and review Worldly wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Stitcher, or Spotify, or anywhere else that you like. We're there. And don't forget, if you are interested in having us answer your questions, send us an email at worldly@vox.com. We will try to take an episode to answer listener questions. Also, some of the questions that you've sent, while very, very smart so far, have not been things that we can answer in roughly 10-minute bursts. So try to think of something with a sort of more narrow focus, if you can. It's okay if you can't and just want to ask us a big question anyway. We'll try to do our best in 10 minutes, but we're going to try to get through as many of these questions as we can. Hopefully we hear from you, and we'll definitely talk to you next week.
Support for this show comes from Mercury. There's an art to making the complex feel simple. Everything should be in sync so that even the smallest part serves a bigger purpose. Simplicity can transform your business operations. That's why Mercury powers your financial workflows from the bank account, so ambitious companies have the precision, control, and focus they need to perform at their best. Apply in minutes at mercury.com.